Concerned with the welfare of the steamer Edmund Fitzgerald. He was right in front of us, experiencing a little difficulty. He was taking on a small amount of water, and none of the upbound ships have passed him. I can see no lights as before, and I don't have him on the radar. I just hope he didn't take a nosedive.
Need for iron ore and steel increased.
On April 12, 1861, Fort Sumter was fired upon by the Confederate troops. This event catapulted the U.S. into a war pitting brother against brother. Iron ore was needed for steel to produce guns, cannons, and farm machinery. This need had a direct impact on the development of the wilderness area in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. As the Civil War ended, the United States saw the beginning of industrial growth. By the 1890s, the U.S. had become the world's largest producer of steel. This industrialization brought the need for a larger workforce. The demand was fulfilled by the rising rate of immigration.
On April 12, 1861, Fort Sumter was fired upon by the Confederate troops. This event catapulted the United States into a war, pitting brother against brother. Iron ore was needed for steel to produce guns, cannon, and farm machinery. This need had a direct impact on the development of the wilderness area in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. As the Civil War ended, the United States saw the beginning of industrial growth. By the 1890s, the U.S. had become the world's largest producer of steel. This industrialization brought the need for a larger workforce. The demand was fulfilled by the rising rate of immigration. Immigrants found jobs throughout the United States in steel mills, factories, oil production, farming, lumbering, textiles, and mining. The discovery of iron ore in Marquette County, located in Michigan's Upper Peninsula by federal surveyors, had attracted the attention of mining promoters throughout the country. Many small communities and hamlets emerged around the mining operations, which began to develop. Marquette County experienced phenomenal growth from 2,821 residents in 1860 to 46,076 residents in 1910.
On April 12, 1861, Fort Sumter was fired upon by the Confederate troops. This event catapulted the U.S. into a war, pitting brother against brother. Iron ore was needed for steel to produce guns, cannons, and farm machinery. This need had a direct impact on the development of the wilderness area in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. As the Civil War ended, the United States saw the beginning of industrial growth. By the 1890s, the U.S. had become the world's largest producer of steel. This industrialization brought the need for a larger workforce. The demand was fulfilled by the rising rate of immigration. Immigrants found jobs throughout the United States in steel mills, factories, oil production, farming, lumbering, textiles, and mining. The discovery of iron ore in Marquette County, located in Michigan's Upper Peninsula by federal surveyors, had attracted the attention of mining promoters throughout the country. Many small communities and hamlets emerged around the mining operations, which began to develop. Marquette County experienced phenomenal growth from 2,821 residents in 1860 to 46,076 residents in 1910. With the advent of the assembly line of production, as well as the United States' involvement in World War I, the need for iron ore and steel increased. To meet this need, an iron ore procurement committee was organized by President Wilson in an effort to produce as much ore as possible. Drilling for ore bodies increased on the Marquette Range. Several mining companies engaged in mining operations in the central portion of the Upper Peninsula. The Cleveland Cliffs Iron Company explored the North Lake District on the Marquette Range from 1915 to 1918. Ore deposits formed throughout this area, and the decision to mine was made. Two mines were opened in the North Lake District, the Lloyd Mine and the Morris Mine. Further explorations discovered another body of ore approximately 1.5 miles west of the Morris Mine. This mine in operation is called the Barnes Hecker Mine, which had an adjacent locality bearing the same name.
On April 12, 1861, Fort Sumter was fired upon by the Confederate troops. This event catapulted the U.S. into a war pitting brother against brother. Iron ore was needed for steel to produce guns, cannon, and farm machinery. This need had a direct impact on the development of the wilderness area and Upper Peninsula of Michigan. As the Civil War ended, the United States saw the beginning of industrial growth. By the 1890s, the U.S. had become the world's largest producer of steel. This industrialization brought the need for a larger workforce. The demand was fulfilled by the rising rate of immigration. Immigrants found jobs throughout the United States in steel mills, factories, oil production, farming, lumbering, textiles, and mining. The discovery of iron ore in the Marquette County, located in Michigan's Upper Peninsula by federal surveyors, had attracted the attention of mining promoters throughout the country. Many small communities and hamlets emerged around the mining operations which began to develop. Marquette County experienced phenomenal growth from 2,821 residents in 1860 to 46,076 residents in 1910.
I remember very well. In fact, I'll never forget it. The day of the disaster, my sister and I were attending school at the Greenwood School, and about 1 o'clock that day, a neighbor, a Mrs. Valenti, came in and told our teacher, Andrea Johnson, something had happened at the Barnes Hecker. She wasn't quite sure what it was, so the teacher dismissed us.
1926, I was a freshman in Michigan High School. And when I entered the bus, there was whispers amongst the school pupils to know that the mine had caved in. I didn't think much of it until I got off the bus and you see the people watching us.
Her older brother Bill was trapped in a mine at this time, and her younger brother Walter, who put his first shift in a mine that day, he was also trapped in a mine at this time. Her other brother Albert, he just came to surface just prior to the disaster, and her other brother, which was a half-brother, climbed to surface and was a sole survivor of the mine.
The funeral was held 2 days later at Bethel Lutheran Church, but the body was at our home, and a lot of people came there, friends and strangers, neighbors, and they brought gifts for us children and food.
The company promised my mother that all the boys would get a job when they become age to work.
Let's line in.
Testing, testing, testing.
A lot of the wives, mothers, whatever of the victims, and it was a real sad sight to see them all crying. And my mother cried steady all the way over there. And I seen the skips of the mine just bailing this water out.
Thank you.
Kitchen lives on from the Chippewa on down to the big lake they call Kitchikumi. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy.
I've experienced some topside damage. I have a fence rail laid down, two vents lost or damaged. I am taking on water and have a list.
Do you have your pumps going?
Yes, both of them.
Home to be chewed when the gales of November came early.
There is a target 19 miles ahead of us, so the target is 9 miles on ahead.
Well, am I going to clear?
Yes, he's going to pass to the west of you.
Well, fine.
Oh, by the way, how are you making out with your problem?
We are holding our own.
The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait when the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain in the face of a hurricane west wind.
I'm very concerned with the welfare of the steamer Edmund Fitzgerald. He was right in front of us experiencing a little difficulty. He was taking on a small amount of water, and none of the upbound ships had passed him. I could see no lights as before, and I don't have him on radar. I just hope he didn't take a nosedive.
It's too rough to feed you. At 7 p.m., a main hatchway gave in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know you. The captain wired in, he had water coming in.
Press button to stop.
The main hatchway gave in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know ya. The captain wired in, he had water coming in, and the good ship and crew was in peril. Later that night, when his lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
I have experienced some topside damage. I have a fence rail laid down, two vents lost or damaged. I am taking on water and have a list.
Do you have your pumps going?
Yes, both of them.
There's a target 19 miles ahead of us, so the target is 9 miles on our head.
Well, am I going to clear?
Yes, he's going to pass the west of you.
Well, fine.
Oh, by the way, how are you making out with your problem?
As they realized their situation, the men were enveloped in total darkness. They had to kick the rail tracks to guide them as they groped their way to the shaft. Reaching the shaft, they realized that the electrically operated cage elevator was also out of commission. Their only means of escape was the emergency ladder, which ran vertically up the shaft. Joe Mankey, the second level skip tender, joined the men at the shaft. They started frantically climbing in order to elude death. Mr. Wills, a strong, lean, young man, climbed more swiftly than his two partners. Climbing 200 feet, he reached the first level ahead of the other men. Here he met Tom Kirby, the first level skip operator, who was unaware of the calamity. Frantically, Wills alerted Kirby of the impending doom. Again, Wills grabbed the ladder and took the lead. There were now four men climbing. As they continued, the water and debris rushed up at them, threatening to tear them from the ladder. Wills felt the ladder shake violently and heard his companions yell. Never looking down, he knew he was alone and that the ladder had fractured beneath him. Water lapped at his boots. Wilford Wills began his race against death. Using his teeth to tear off his gloves, Wills aided his ability to retain a firm grip on the ladder. Beyond human comprehension, Wills pushed himself, propelling his legs in a continual pumping motion, fixing his gaze on the ever-widening speck of light at the top of the shaft. A human face appeared in the lighted opening. A voice beckoned and encouraged him. The voice calling to Wills was his half-brother Albert Tippett, who grabbed him by his jacket and pulled him out of the shaft. In only 10 minutes, Wilfred Wills had climbed 800 feet, nearly the height of the Eiffel Tower. The race ended and the victor collapsed in exhaustion. News of the cave-in reached the Morris mine in minutes. Fearing for the safety of the men in this mine, Mr. Charles Stakel rushed underground to the sixth level of the Morris mine to inspect the tunnel connecting it to the third level of the Barnes Hecker. It was here that he and several other workers discovered the bodies of seven men who apparently tried to flee through the only other escape route available to them. Mr. Stakel also discovered that the raise connecting the two levels was plugged with enough debris and timber to resist the water pressure from the Barnes Hecker. This temporary plug saved the Morris mine from flooding. The Barnes Hecker cave-in became Michigan's worst mine disaster. News of the tragedy traveled like an electric shock throughout the community. Children of the victims were sent home.
I remember very well, in fact, I'll never forget it, the day of the disaster. My sister and I were attending school at the Greenwood School, and about 1 o'clock that day, a neighbor, a Mrs. Valenti, came in and told our teacher, Andrea Johnson, something had happened at the Barnes Hecker. She wasn't quite sure what it was. So the teacher dismissed us.
1926, I was a freshman in Michigan High School. And when I entered the bus, there was whispers amongst the school pupils, you know, that the mine had caved in. I didn't think much of it until I got off the bus, and you see the people watching us.
Few families remained untouched by the tragedy. Some families lost more than one family member.
Her older brother, Bill, was trapped in a mine at this time, and her younger brother, Walter, who put his first shift in a mine that day, he was also trapped in a mine at this time. Her other brother, Albert, he just came to surface just prior to the disaster, and her other brother, which was a half-brother, climbed to surface and was a sole survivor of the mine disaster.
Mrs. Wilfred Wills had joy in her husband's heroic escape, but sorrow in the loss of her father, Sam Phillippe. Joe Mankey, who lost his life in the frantic climb on the shaft ladder, had been the best man at the wedding of Wilfred Wills. The entire community was engulfed in grief. Widows found comfort in their children in whom the father's spirit still lived. Of the bodies rescued, the first funeral was held for Mr. William Hill, the mine inspector.
The funeral was held 2 days later at Bethel Lutheran Church, but the body was at our home, and a lot of people came there.
Concerned with the welfare of the steamer Everett Fitzgerald. right in front of us experiencing a little difficulty. He was taking on a small amount of water, and none of the upbound ships had passed him. I could see no lights as before, and I don't have him on radar. I just hope he didn't take a nosedive. Press button to
stop. Carbide lamps. At the same time, they heard an awful thundering noise inside the mine. The two cents. Kit County experienced phenomenal growth from 2,821 residents in 1860 to 46,076 residents in 1910. With the advent of the assembly line of production, as well as the United States' involvement in World War I, the need for
Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Kitchigumi. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling? The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound when the wave broke over the railing. And every man knew, as the captain did too, 'twas the witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait when the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain in the face of a hurricane west wind. At 7 p.m. a main hatchway gave in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know you. The captain wired in, he had water coming in, and the good ship and crew was in peril. Later that night when his lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Of God goes when the words turn the minutes to hours. The searchers all say they'd have made Whitefish Bay if they'd put 15 more miles behind her. They might have split up or they might have capsized. They may have broke deep and of water. And all that remains is the faces and the names of the wives and the sons and the daughters. Michigan steams like a young man's dreams. The islands and bays are for sportsmen. And farther below, Lake Ontario takes in what Lake Erie can send her. The iron boats go as the mariners all know, with the gales of November remembered. The church bell chimed till it rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. And the legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitchagumi. Superior, they said, never gives up for dead when the gales of November come early. Thank you.
afternoon of November 9th, 1975, the Edmund Fitzgerald left Superior, Wisconsin for Detroit, Michigan with a load of taconite pellets. Around 4:15 p.m., she met the Arthur M. Anderson, who would accompany her across Lake Superior. Captain Jesse Cooper of Anderson and Captain Ernest McSorley of the Fitzgerald conversed by radio telephone and agreed to take the northern route across Lake Superior. This offered more protection since a severe storm had been predicted. As the ships traveled across Lake Superior, the storm grew with intensity until snow and 80 mile per hour winds caused rough seas and poor visibility. Nevertheless, the ships continued and the Fitzgerald passed 6 fathom shoal off of Caribou Island. At 3:30 p.m., McSorley radioed Captain Cooper and a brief conversation took place.
I have Oh, crap.
Oh.
It's off.
Period. Captain Jesse Cooper of the Anderson and Captain Ernest McSorley of the Fitzgerald conversed by radio telephone and agreed to take the northern route across Lake Superior. This offered more protection since a severe storm had been predicted. As the ships traveled across Lake Superior, the storm grew with intensity until snow and 80 mile per hour winds caused rough seas and poor visibility. Nevertheless, the ships continued and the Fitzgerald passed 6 fathom shoal off of Caribou Island. At 3:30 p.m., McSorley radioed Captain Cooper, and a brief conversation took place.
I have experienced some topside damage. I have a fence rail laid down, 2 vents lost or damaged. I am taking on water, and I have a list.
Do you have your pumps going?
Yes, both of them.
McSorley then told Cooper that he was slowing down to let Anderson catch up with him and keep an eye on them. Around 4:10 p.m., McSorley radioed the Anderson to inform them that he needed navigational help because his radar antenna had blown off. The Anderson agreed to give him help. Around 7:15 p.m., the first mate, Morgan Clark, informed McSorley of an approaching vessel.
There is a target 19 miles ahead of us, so the target is 9 miles on ahead.
Well, am I going to clear?
Yes, he is going to pass the rest of you.
Well, fine.
Oh, by the way, how are you making out with your problem?
We are holding our own.
Those were the last words heard from the Edmund Fitzgerald. At 7:25, the Fitzgerald disappeared from the radar. Since it had stopped snowing, the men on the Anderson searched the lake for lights. Captain Cooper voiced instructions to his men.
He may have had a power blackout. Look for a silhouette.
Meanwhile, Cooper tried unsuccessfully to contact the Edmund Fitzgerald, and as time passed on, he became increasingly worried. He then radioed the Coast Guard at Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan.
I'm very concerned with the welfare of the streamer Edmund Fitzgerald. He was right in front of us, experiencing a little difficulty. He was taking on a small amount of water, and none of the upbound ships had passed him. I see no lights as before, and I don't have him on radar. I just hope he didn't take a nosedive. In front of us, experiencing a little difficulty, he was taking on a small amount of water, and none of the upbound ships had passed him. I see no lights as before, and I don't have him on radar. I just hope he didn't take a nosedive.